The Lounge, stories of the Tasmanian Aboriginal peoples, sharing stories around the campfire. The Lounge at Mac One is the place where guests have their first encounter with the people and culture of the unique island of Tasmania. Arrival and entry to the hotel engages each guest with the history of European exploration and discovery, reflecting their own anticipation and wonder at the sights, sounds, experiences and stories that they are about to encounter during their stay at Tasmania's storytelling hotel. In the same way as the early Dutch, French and British explorers did, as they first gazed at a mysterious shore from a ship's deck nearly 500 years ago, guests will realise that these lands, while remote and splendid in their natural glory, were not empty. Just as those first explorers sought new lands, scientific discoveries, and for convicts and settlers, a new beginning, the experience of the Mac One Lounge will be to encounter the wonder of a culture and a people living beyond the realms of the imagination. Amidst objects that evoke the deep wilderness heart of Tasmania, its sandy, crystalline bays and a natural bounty of plants and animals for food, healing and shelter, the greatest reward will be the discovery of a place that is somehow familiar and inviting. Guests are invited to share in the sights and stories of Aboriginal Tasmania around the campfire in a way that has served as a traditional welcome for thousands of years. As guests first sample to the world of Indigenous storytelling, the sense of novelty and mystery that might be experienced in a museum is gently replaced by a suggestion that this is deeply familiar. On the shores of Tasmania, an eternity away from their daily life, they will find stories that dissolve the barriers of time and distance, honouring and celebrating the human stories that speak to the deep aspirations and values of their own lives. Reconnecting with the past to recover what has been lost or left behind, revealing the meaningful by cutting beneath the superficial, rediscovering something genuine and lasting in our busy digital lives. Encountering these stories at Mac One offers guests a window into the captivating character of Tasmania. 40,000 years of stories that are unexpected, romantic and mysterious. A faraway place of past conflict on an island of contradiction, of war and conciliation, hardship and survival, generosity and deep human emotion. The campfire objects and stories in the lounge reveal the hidden beauty of Indigenous Tasmania, where enthralling characters cross the boundaries of culture and precious cultural practices challenge what we thought we knew about the world. The culture of fire. Fire is a common part of almost everyone's life. However, these days it is seldom seen in the home. For many, fire is associated with danger and destruction. We have lost touch with its life-giving role, but fire is humanity's oldest friend. It enabled our ancestors to warm themselves at night, to protect against predators and to form the metals that began our technological era. Fire is an essential part of every culture. It is at the heart of family and community life. In Aboriginal Tasmania, fire is the focus of society. Within its sacred light, laws are made and renewed. Language is kept alive. Around the fire, stories are told and knowledge shared. Stories of the day's events woven in with tales carried by elders that are older than living memory. Oral traditions remind us how to live with nature and to care for the earth with each other. Familiar stories of a garden of paradise and folk tales such as Beauty and the Beast date back from before the written word. Aboriginal people in Tasmania have used fire for thousands of years to shape the forests and the grasslands. Careful burning at the correct time of year maintains the young, fresh growth on which wallabies and kangaroos thrive. It creates habitats for the orange-bellied parrot, one of the world's rarest birds. The baskets are never empty. Patiently woven by skilled hands, each Tasmanian Aboriginal basket is the product of hours of skilled twining, stitching and knotting. It is also the result of generations of learning carried by stories shared by the basket makers. French and British explorers collected these beautiful baskets when they first landed on Tasmanian shores. They contained the tools of everyday life for fire making and ceremony. Their makers, when diving for abalone and crayfish, used specially made baskets with an open weave to let the water through. Others were tightly woven to carry ochre and other sacred objects. Today, the baskets express creativity and personal connection to land and culture. They are never empty. Each basket is full of stories, shared with every stitch, telling of the lives of the makers and the people and places that are important to them. The baskets carry culture from one generation to the next. Circles of culture. Delicate iridescent shell necklaces have been made by Tasmanian Aboriginal women for hundreds of generations, representing one of the oldest continuing cultural practices in the world. Countless hours in the life of a stringer are spent scouring remote beaches to collect, by hand, these rare and beautiful shells. Each must then be cleaned and individually threaded to make these highly sought-after necklaces, collected by museums and art galleries across the world. Each stringer has her own favoured places to collect the shells. Their whereabouts are closely guarded secret. Every necklace is as individual as its maker, who can be recognised by the particular patterns of shells that create their cultural signature. Each stringer's artistic practice draws on traditions handed down by her elders, her mother, aunts or grandmother. These shell necklaces are one of Tasmania's unique cultural jewels. The Mayrinier necklace carries an important message of cultural strength and resilience. The practice has survived for thousands of years as an icon of enduring human creativity. Necklace making has continued despite the impact of British colonization, which reduced the Tasmanian Aboriginal population from many thousands to only a few hundred. As Aboriginal women passed on their knowledge to daughters and granddaughters, they passed on the survival and strength of an ancient culture. The Mayrinier shells are of exquisite aesthetic beauty. The green and blue iridescent colours reflect the interplay of sea, forest and sky that characterise Tasmania's natural beauty. The incorporation of other shells by individual makers integrate the varied colours of ocean, sand, coastal plants and birdlife. Today, the numbers and distribution of shells are shifting as the seasons are affected by climate change. A tradition that has survived for 100 centuries or more may be threatened by the consequences of industry and technology. The Mayrinier necklace is a rare and precious creation that speaks to us of resilience but also of vulnerability. The best whale spotter in all the southern seas. Whaling was one of Tasmania's earliest colonial industries. It is also one of the first professions in which Tasmanian Aboriginal people came to excel. William Lane is often referred to as King Billy. He worked on a number of whaling vessels that tied up just outside Mac One Hotel at Macquarie Wharf. William joined Indigenous people from across the Pacific in an industry made famous by Herman Melville's novel Moby Dick. This famous story was written around the time that William ranged the Southern Ocean with the crews of ships such as the Aladdin and the Runnymede. One of the key characters in Moby Dick is the South Sea Islander, Queequeg. Perhaps, if Melville had known William Lane, he could have easily been the model for the famous character. William Lane. Tasmanian Aborigines are often the subject of a tragic history. Individuals such as William Lane reveal an inspiring and legendary world with connections across the world to an era of adventure and danger. Hobart Town in the 1860s attracted characters from across the world. William Lane carved a place for himself in history as a young man of talent in a world as complex as the story of Moby Dick itself, torn by the tides of obsession, power, democracy, and justice. Importantly, Moby Dick was written at a time when Tasmanian Aboriginal families were adapting to new social and cultural ways, building a new world for themselves in the aftermath of the Black War, in which Aboriginal warriors fought to expel the British colonists from their island. The struggle was a testament to the strength and resolve of Tasmanian Aboriginal people to keep their culture strong and to share its wisdom and stories with visitors from across the world who come to their shores. Forests of kelp. The coastal kelp forests of Tasmania are a paragon of the island's hidden natural beauty. They are not only a popular venue for recreational diving, but sites of rich biodiversity, home to leafy sea dragons and a host of fish species, seals and other ocean life. They are also the source of abalone, a celebrated Tasmanian gourmet product. Kelp forests were also the domain of Tasmanian Aboriginal women who dived for shellfish and hunted seals on Tasmania's many offshore islands. With the arrival of British colonists, these women utilised their unique freediving skills for salvage of shipwrecks in Tasmanian waters. Kelp was used by Tasmanian Aborigines as a material for making water carriers. This, like the story of Aboriginal involvement in the whaling industry, as a story of resilience and cultural strength, where ancient traditional skills became valued as part of new lifestyles and industries of colonial Tasmania. The ability of Aboriginal women to dive unaided in Tasmanian waters illustrates perfectly the closeness of Tasmanian Aboriginal culture to the resources that supported their way of life. 40,000 years of unbroken history. Old Wharf Restaurant. Stories of early industry. Whaling, going, going, gone. In 1803, the whaling ship Albion took three whales at Great Oyster Bay, the first recorded catch in Tasmanian waters. The large number of whales was noted by the settlement's commander, Lieutenant David Collins, and with the market identified, the killing commenced. The whaling trade drove the economy of the young colony. The streetlights of London were fueled by the blubber of the whales of Tasmania and the corsets of the rich of the Europe by their bones. Whaling started with bay whaling around the shores of Tasmania, targeting the sedate southern right whales and humpback whales. When they were all taken, the whalers moved offshore to Old Ironside, the sperm whales. Hobart became a whaling centre as boats were built, serviced and sailed to exploit the resource. Foreign boats arrived to replenish. The foreshore pub life boomed and the character of the colony developed. Farming and fisheries, wheat, wool and oyster. The Tasmanian farmers, once established in the 1820s with sheep, cattle and wheat, started to feed the nation. As the free settlers arrived and were given freehold, the convicts increasingly became part of the labour and market forces as they finished their sentences. The land was fertile, it rained, and a workforce began to apply market-driven principles over the bartering system to date. Van Diemen's Land started to boom, from prison farm to free market, from no sheep to 1.75 million of them. Then it went bust. Australia began to grow wheat, shear sheep and diversify, while the fledgling country now called Tasmania tried to compete but failed without capital. Fishery started to play a role. Native oysters, the first major fishery, whales aren't fish, helped edge the crash. Abalone were harvested, dried and exported to China. Crayfish were harvested. Mining rocks the economy. The native inhabitants had used the ochre, flint and salt minerals which they traded. The convicts dug sandstone for mansions, bridges and roads, mined limestone for fertilizers and coal to burn. In a struggling economy, the inveterate prospectors never gave up, swarming through the undergrowth of the west coast until they found the Mount Reid volcanics. A country was saved by a 10 million year event 500 million years ago. Underwater volcanoes erupted into the ocean and sulfides of iron, silver, copper, zinc, gold and lead were deposited. 500 million years later, they were discovered by the gritty, resilient, stubborn prospectors. A mountain of tin at Mount Bischoff, then a silver and lead monster near Zeehan, and the iron blow at Mount Lyell. Coal and gold followed in the east and the economy was on a boom. The mining industry yielded a wealth plus a people. People of the west coast were resilient yet compassionate and cashed up yet isolated. However, mining brings danger and, while tragedies, these stories remain a deep part of the Tasmanian character. A disaster deep underground at Mount Lyell left 43 people dead. On Monday the 14th of October, 1,100 feet of rope was lowered down the main shaft of the mine. Attached to it was a signal gong. It was originally meant for the men working on fixing the skids in the shaft. However, late in the afternoon, watchers heard the rap of the line. It sent the message, "Pull to service." When the rope was pulled up, a handkerchief wrapped around a tobacco tin was attached to it. Inside the tin was a penciled note, 40 men and 40 stope. Send food and candles at once. No time to lose. J. Ryan. During the rescue party's attempts to find any still alive in the stifling depths, they came across a group of men on the 700-foot level. One of those, Joe McCarthy, left a note pinned to a timber with a spider, a tool the miners used to hold their candles. The note read, 700 level, North Lyell Mine, 12-10-12. If any should find this note, convey to my wife. Dear Agnes, I will say goodbye. Sure I will not see you again anymore. I am pleased to have made a little provision for you and poor little Lorna. Be good to our little darling. My mate, Len Burke, is done, and poor old V and driver too. Goodbye with love to all. Your loving husband, Joe McCarthy. Boat building, an island for boats, boat builders and boating. When convicts were transported to Sarah Island in Macquarie Harbour, boat building became part of the tools to subdue them and exploit their labour and skills. Boats were built between 1824 and 1833, most out of Tasmania's finest timber. 18 vessels over 16 and some over 250 tonnes, 22 launches up to 10 tonnes and 46 whale boats and other small craft. Names such as William IV, Frederick, Governor Sorrel and Cyprus graced the hulls. Enterprising convicts fled on some, and those on the Frederick making it all the way to South America. Boats then became the mode of transport port for people and goods. In the south, the vegetable produce of the Huon region was carried to the port of Hobart by inshore schooners. Check this. In the north, Bass Strait conditions meant the trading ketch was used. A rugged canoe stern double master built in backyards and on riverbanks became the main mode of transport. The boats were rough and unreliable with the rains in the fertile regions, so produce was moved along the coast and between the islands in these rugged, reliable and rough boats. The Wastelands Act of 1858 opened up the difficult country to the settlers. Boats were the tool of the trade. Their round, shallow hulls allowed entry to the tidal rivers, but also provided safe passage. Boats frequented the Duck, Don, Mersey and Meander rivers, trading from Woolnorth to Bridport, Trefoil to Tin Kettle Island, and servicing lighthouses on Deal, Goose and Swan Islands. The canoe stern ketches morphed into fishing boats, but some, such as the Julie Burgess, Ripple, Leslie and Wild Wind, traded through to the recent times. The Wild Wind, built by two men on the banks of a northwest river, still trades today, albeit at the skipper's own pace. The Story Bar. Stories of an island of conflict and tragedy, yet achievement and unity. Grey to green, politics on land. Governors ruled the land. The Legislative Council had not one elected member, but freedom was never far. The first political grouping was the Grand Political Group of 1835. A paper, The True Colonist, tackled issues of the social and political condition, while the Cornwall Chronicle published political cartoons of Governor Franklin. Censorship was attempted. In 1869, around 12,000 men could vote, 40,000 of the male population, while women could not. 217 people could vote twice, 73 times, 28 four times, and four could cast 5 votes each. They rode miles to vote in different electorates. In 1871, 2,797 qualified to vote for Legislative Council and 14,036 for House of Assembly out of 100,000 population. Hare-Clark voting methodology started in 1896, the best representation of one man's vote across the voting peoples. Total number of valid votes plus one divided by number of vacancies plus one. Tasmanian women became eligible to vote in the House of Assembly elections in 1904 following a change to the eligibility criteria from man to person in the Constitution Act. Although this allowed women to vote, they were still not eligible to stand for election. Then, in 1972, the United Tasmanian Group was formed by a remarkable visionary, Dr. Richard Jones. Green politics had arrived ahead of the world stage, the world's first Green Party. Tourism, a Tasmanian character. The climate drove tourism from the 1830s because it was considered a healthy, cool climate compared with the stifling heat of Australia or the damp life back in the motherland. Tasmania was marketed as bright, breezy and bracing. Around 1890, tourism was a calculated part of the economy and statistics were kept showing a decline from 18,000 tourists in 1890 to 12,000 in 1893. Declines and complaints about facilities drove government action. In the 1900s, the Tasmanian Tourism Association was founded. Alliances were formed with artists such as Horton Forrest and photographer J.W. Beattie, leading to the stunning pictorial postage stamps of 1900. The beauty of Tasmania had become part of its economy, and certainly its character was valued in this way. The worth of national parks was realised and a new course was set. Frank Hurley was contracted to produce tourism movies. Tourism around nature is not new for Tasmania, but like green politics, it is a result of Tasmania. public houses, the Working Man's Pub. The first recorded pub was the Hope and Anchor when Rev Robert Knopwood dined there in 1807. Then there were 18 such public houses in 1818, and by 1840 there were 280 of them. The opening up of the roadways drove more need for public houses, and the mining boom resulted in many more. The working class led to the unions, which led to a character of Tasmanians supported by the pub's reliability of existence. Today, the pubs still hold a traditional place of safety for the traveller and familiarity for the local. One's local pub is one's own. Sport and community, a strong bond of character. 60% of Tasmanians live outside of Hobart. Sporting clubs and community groups are the glue of society and behaviour, and small towns flourish if they have a school, sporting club, and thereby pride. Shooting and horse racing were the first sports to captivate Tasmanians, and betting on the horses dominated. The port-based maritime community gave rise to rowing as a major sport, then cricket. Australian rules football and cycling followed, all sports at which Tasmanians still excel. Wood chopping came out of the pioneering forestry activities of trapping and timber cutting. Footy is probably the people's game, where Tasmanians have proved most successful, providing a plethora of players as renowned as Casserly of Up There Casserly fame, and as prolific as Hudson, who kicked 2,191 goals in 333 senior matches. On an international level, it's the Sydney to Hobart, a race that carries the spirit of the beginning when the sealers, scoundrels and settlers travelled from the Big Island to Tasmania to colonise the island. They raced to the riches then and still race to it today. Ground floor bathrooms. In times gone by, at the locations of the ground floor bathrooms, you would have been sitting in the low-lying, flood-prone, lower-class district known as Wapping, through which flowed the then highly polluted Hobart Rivulet. Male toilet doors. Toilet 1, the new cut, a bad idea. In an effort to redirect the volatile Hobart Town Rivulet away from the harbour where maritime industries were, at the time, flourishing, the 1824 new cut channeled the rivulet behind the old wharf, later the H. Jones & Co. Jam Factory. Unfortunately, during heavy rains, this caused the Hobart Town Rivulet to join forces with the Park Street Rivulet, forming a levee and flooding the harbourside area of Wapping. Originally, the rivulet's flow ended in the Derwent River. Later, however, the rivulet's path was narrowed into the new Gasworks Straits Canal on its way there. The area where the Straits met the Derwent, next to Hobart Town's main abattoir, was regrettably the location chosen to dispose of both the town's human and animal waste. Effluent was tipped from barges into the water and unused animal parts discarded conveniently close to where they had been processed. All in all, the new cut was a triumph of filth and degradation, incredibly only done away with almost a century later. The eventual filling in of the Gasworks Straits was a much welcome development, achieved partially with apricot stones from the IXL Jam Factory. Toilet number 2, from pit to pan. In 1887, a typhoid epidemic wreaked havoc in Hobart Town due to advancements in the local sanitary system being poorly managed by the council. Residents were uncooperative. Only 26 houses in Wapping had registered on the 1887 sanitation list, and only 600 homes in the whole of Hobart Town. The previous cesspit system was now updated to the pan system, wherein the full pan was removed to the depot to be scoured and scraped, and a clean one was left as a replacement. Sewage from the depot went out onto the estuary in a contractor's boat and was dumped. However, at low tide, the boat wasn't able to make it past the silt bar in the Gasworks Straits, so the sewage was dumped there instead as a matter of convenience. Labour newspaper, The Clipper, reached the conclusion, cleanliness is an extra cost, dirtiness is cheap. Ladies' toilet doors. Toilet 1. Vegetables, anyone? The main slaughterhouse adjacent to the Gasworks Straits in 1893 certainly occupied an inauspicious position. Unwholesome surrounds, fumes of ammonia, gas and other effluents certainly didn't improve the flavours of the meat hanging in sheds just 100 yards from the rivulet. At that time, a common sewer with the greatest quantity of matter in it. With such objectionable neighbours to the city's meat supply, a night soil receiving shed, the gasworks, and an open, shallow sewer, vegetables anyone? Toilet number 2. They call this showbiz. In April 1960, Mount Wellington sent a vast volume of water into Hobart via the rivulet, causing great damage and disruption to many businesses. Especially affected were two movie houses, the Tatler and the Variety, both operating from basements, and neighbours to the Rivulet and its violent course that day. The Tatler, after an exhaustive clean-up, was able to reopen with an amusing advertisement in the Mercury newspaper referring to itself as the finest underwater theatrette in the world. The Variety, however, never traded again after a rather dramatic evacuation halfway through a screening. The film in question, Sophia Loren's Woman of the River. Toilet number three, a public spectacle. John Taylor was born in early Hobart Town and became one of the city's foremost town criers. Known for his barking voice, he earned the name Dog. When Dog needed to inform the public of something off the record, he made sure to do it out of earshot of the gentry, public buildings, and from the would-be paths of officials. Instead, a declaration would be made down at the old wharf where seafarers, whalers, sealers, ex-convicts and factory workers could hear about it and, if they wished, attend the event in question. In this case, the ever-popular ducking pond. The recipient of this ducking was any woman who had become a public nuisance, arguing with neighbours, drunk and disorderly, or any other behaviour causing disruption to public peace. The offender, after being apprehended, was restrained in a chair attached to two long poles and dunked in a deep section of the Hobart Rivulet as many times as was needed to cool her immoderate heat. Equal access toilet door. Toilet number one. First in a long history of environmentalists. In 1804, Lieutenant Governor David Collins, having been at Sullivan's Cove for only 2 days, issued a public order declaring it a punishable offence to draw water from the rivulet, other than at two prescribed locations. Punishable too was the offence of clearing scrub or bush from the fringes of the stream in an effort to prevent soil erosion. Collins had seen firsthand three times the effects of a polluted freshwater source had on a new settlement and had clearly outlined his desire for its preservation, making him our first European environmentalist. Every story has an end. This audio recording has been narrated and produced by Lisa B. Please subscribe and stay tuned for more books Ross hasn't got around to reading and can't find an audio version of. Thanks for listening.